make a routine of stopping for a burp. Burp 2, anytime baby seems to want to quit feeding too soon or starts fussing at the nipple. It may be gas, not food, filling that little tummy. Bring up the bubble and you're back in business. Make contact. Cuddle and caress your baby with your hands, your eyes, and your voice. Remember, meals should fill your baby's daily requirements, not just for nutrients, but for love and attention as well.
Cracking the crying code. Sure, crying is a baby's only form of communication, but that doesn't mean you'll always know exactly what he or she is trying to say. Not to worry. This cheat sheet can help you figure out what those whimpers, wails, and shrieks really mean. I'm hungry. A short and low-pitched cry that rises and falls rhythmically and has a pleading quality to it, as in, please, please feed me, usually means that baby's in the market for a meal. The hunger cry is often preceded by hunger cues, such as lip smacking, rooting, or finger sucking. Catch on to the clues and you can often avoid the tears. I'm in pain. This cry begins suddenly, usually in response to something unexpectedly painful, for instance, the jab of a needle at shot time, and is loud as an ear piercing, panicked and long, with each wail lasting as long as a few seconds, leaving the baby breathless. It's followed by a long pause. That's baby catching his or her breath, saving up for another chorus, and then repeated long, high-pitched shrieks. I'm bored. This cry starts out as coos, as baby tries to get a good interaction going, then turns into fussing when the attention he or she is craving isn't forthcoming, then builds to bursts of indignant crying. Why are you ignoring me? Alternating with whimpers. Come on, what's a baby got to do to get a cuddle around here? The boredom cry stops as soon as baby is picked up or played with. I'm overtired or uncomfortable. A whiny, nasal, continuous cry that builds in intensity is usually baby's signal that he or she has had enough, as in nap please, or clean diaper pronto, or can't you see I've had it with this infant seat? I'm sick. This cry is often weak and nasal sounding, with a lower pitch than the pain or overtired cry, as though baby just doesn't have the energy to pump up the volume. It's often accompanied by other signs of illness and changes in the baby's behavior. For example, listlessness, refusal to eat, fever, and or diarrhea. There's no sadder cry in baby's repertoire, or one that tugs harder at parental heartstrings than the sick cry. Quivering chin.
Sometimes, especially when he's been crying, my baby's chin quivers.
Though your baby's quivering chin may look like just another precious ploy to play the cute card, it's actually a sign that his nervous system is age-appropriately immature. As it matures, that quivering chin will disappear. But that's okay, since he'll find plenty of other adorable ways to make you melt. Startling.
I'm worried that there's something wrong with my baby's nervous system. Even when she's sleeping, she'll suddenly seem to jump out of her skin.
It's startling to parents, but startling is second nature for newborns. One of the many, very normal, though seemingly peculiar, reflexes babies are born with. Also known as the Morrow reflex, the startle reflex occurs more frequently in some babies than in others, sometimes for no apparent reason, but most often in response to a loud noise, jolting, or feeling of falling, as when a newborn is picked up or placed down without enough support. Like many other reflexes, the Morrow is probably a built-in survival mechanism designed to protect these newborns. In this case, a primitive attempt to regain perceived loss of equilibrium. In a Morrow, the baby typically stiffens her body, flings her arms up and out symmetrically, spreads her usually tightly clenched fists wide open, draws her knees up, and then finally brings her arms, fists clenched once again, back to her body in an embracing gesture, all in a matter of seconds. She may also cry out. While the sight of a startled baby often startles her parents, a doctor is more likely to be concerned if a baby doesn't exhibit this reflex. Newborns are routinely tested for startling, the presence of which is actually one reassuring sign that the neurological system is functioning well. You'll find that your baby will gradually startle less frequently and less dramatically, and that the reflex will disappear fully somewhere between 4 and 6 months. Your baby may occasionally startle, of course, at any age, just as adults can, but not with the same pattern of reactions.
For parents, newly delivered? Sure, you're all about how to care for your baby right now, but chances are you have just as many questions about how to care for yourself. For answers on everything you might wonder and worry about during your 6-week recovery period, from bloody discharge to hemorrhoids, hair loss to night sweats, exhaustion to depression, that first bowel movement to that first postpartum checkup to the first postpartum period. Check out chapters 17 and 18 in What to Expect When You're Expecting. Newborn reflexes. Mother Nature pulls out all the stops when it comes to newborn babies, providing them with a set of inborn reflexes designed to protect these vulnerable creatures and ensure their care, even if parental instincts have yet to kick in. Some of these primitive behaviors are spontaneous, while others are responses to certain actions. Some seem intended to shield a baby from harm, such as when a baby swipes at something covering his or her face, a reflex that is meant to prevent suffocation. Others seem to guarantee that a baby will get fed, as when a hungry newborn roots for a nipple. And while many of the reflexes have obvious value as survival mechanisms, nature's intentions are more subtle in others. Take the fencing reflex. Though few newborns are challenged to a duel, it's theorized that they take this challenging stance while on their backs to prevent themselves from rolling away from their moms. Newborn reflexes include rooting reflex. A newborn whose cheek is gently stroked will turn in the direction of the stimulus, mouth open and ready to feed. This reflex helps the baby locate the breast or bottle and secure a meal, sort of like a feeding GPS. Your baby will do this for 3 to 4 months, though rooting may persist long after that during sleep. Sucking reflex. A newborn will reflexively suck when something, for example a nipple, touches the roof of his or her mouth. This reflex is present at birth and lasts until 2 to 4 months when voluntary sucking takes over. Again, it's nature's way of making sure baby scores those feeds. Startle or Moro reflex. When startled by a sudden or loud noise or a feeling of falling, the Moro reflex will cause the baby to extend the legs, arms, and fingers, arch the back, draw the head back, then draw the arms back, fists clenched into the chest. Expect this reflex to last around 4 to 6 months. Palmer grasping reflex. Touch the palm of your baby's hand, and those tiny fingers will curl around and cling to your finger or any object. An interesting bit of baby trivia. A newborn's grasp may be powerful enough to support his or her full body weight, but no need to test this out. Some more trivia. This reflex curls baby's feet and toes, too, when they're touched. You'll notice the firm grip lasting 3 to 6 months. Babinski's or plantar reflex. When the sole of a baby's foot is gently stroked from heel to toe, the baby's toes flare upward and the foot turns in. This reflex lasts between 6 months and 2 years, after which toes curl downward. Walking or stepping reflex. Held upright on a table or other flat surface, supported under the arms, a newborn may lift one leg and then the other, taking what seem to be steps. This practice walking reflex works best after the 4th day of life and usually lasts around 2 months. Endlessly entertaining to watch,
But before you post your apparent prodigy's feats on 2 feet, keep in mind that this reflex doesn't predict early walking. Tonic neck or fencing reflex. Placed on the back, a young baby will assume a fencing position, head to one side, with the arm on that side extended, and the opposite limbs flexed. This on guard reflex, which may be a baby's way of being on guard on his back, may be present at birth and may not appear for at least 2 months, and it usually disappears at about 4 to 6 months, though it varies a lot. For fun, or out of curiosity, you can try checking your baby for these reflexes, but keep in mind that your results may vary and will probably be less reliable than those of a doctor or other expert. A baby's reflexes may be less pronounced, too, if he or she is hungry or tired. So try again another day. And if you still can't observe the reflexes, mention this to your baby's doctor, who probably has already tested your baby successfully for all newborn reflexes and will be happy to repeat the demonstrations for you at the next well baby visit.
Birthmarks. I've just noticed a raised, bright red blotch on my daughter's tummy. Is this a birthmark? Will it ever go away? They come in all shapes, sizes, textures, and colors, and they don't always show up at birth, sometimes making their appearance in the first few weeks of life. But birthmarks are practically standard issue for newborns, with more than 80% of infants sporting at least one. And though some birthmarks will last a lifetime, others will fade fast, and still others will fade over time. Sometimes the mark will grow a bit before it begins regressing. How long will a birthmark stick around? When will it start to fade or shrink? That's hard to predict. One thing is for sure, even a birthmark that's destined to disappear won't vanish overnight. In fact, it will likely fade or shrink so gradually, the changes may be hard for you to notice at all. For that reason, many doctors document birthmark changes by photographing and measuring the mark periodically. If your baby's doctor doesn't, you can do so to keep track, or just for a memento. Birthmarks usually fit into one of the following categories. Strawberry hemangioma. This soft, raised, strawberry red birthmark, as small as a freckle or as large as a coaster, is composed of immature veins and capillaries that broke away from the circulatory system during fetal development. It may be visible at birth, but typically appears suddenly during the first few weeks of life, and is so common that 1 out of 10 babies will probably have one. Strawberry birthmarks grow for a while, but eventually start to fade to a pearly gray and almost always finally disappear completely sometime between ages 5 and 10. Occasionally, a strawberry mark may bleed, either spontaneously or because it was scratched or bumped. If that happens, just apply pressure to stem the flow of blood. Strawberry birthmarks are often best left untreated, even if you're eager for your baby's mark to disappear. Unless they continue to grow, repeatedly bleed or become infected, or interfere with a function, such as vision. Treatment from compression and massage to steroids, surgery, laser therapy, cryotherapy, injections, or oral medications can sometimes lead to more complications than a more conservative, let it resolve on its own approach. Much less common are cavernous or venous hemangiomas. Only 1 or 2 out of every 100 babies has this kind. Often combined with the strawberry type, these birthmarks tend to be deeper and larger and are light to deep blue in color. They regress more slowly and less completely than strawberry hemangiomas and are more likely to require treatment, but usually not until a child is older. Salmon patch or nevus simplex, aka stork bites or angel bites. These salmon-colored patches can appear on the forehead, the upper eyelids, and around the nose and mouth, but are most often seen at the nape of the neck, where the fabled stork carries a baby, thus the nickname stork bites. they invariably become lighter during the first 2 years of life, becoming noticeable only when a little one cries or exerts herself. Since more than 95% of the lesions on the face fade completely, these cause less concern, cosmetically, than other birthmarks. Those on the neck that don't fade will eventually be covered by baby's hair as it grows in. Port wine stain, or nevus flammeus. These purplish-red birthmarks, which may appear anywhere on the body, are composed of dilated, mature capillaries. They're normally present at birth as flat or barely elevated pink or reddish-purple lesions. Though they may change color slightly, they don't fade appreciably over time and can be considered permanent, though treatment with a pulse-dyed laser anytime from infancy through adulthood can improve appearance. Café au lait spots. These flat patches on the skin, which can range in color from tan, coffee with a lot of milk, to light brown, coffee with a touch of milk, can turn up anywhere on the body. They're quite common, apparent either at birth or during the first few years of life, and don't disappear. If your child has a large number of café au lait spots, 6 or more, point this out to her doctor. Mongolian spots. Blue to slate gray, resembling bruises, Mongolian spots may turn up on the buttocks or back, and sometimes the legs and shoulders of 9 out of 10 children with African, Asian, or Indian ancestry. These blotchy patches, which can be quite large, are also fairly common in infants of Mediterranean ancestry, but are rare in blonde-haired, blue-eyed infants. Though most often present at birth and gone within the first year, occasionally they don't appear until later and/or persist into adulthood. Congenital pigmented nevi. These moles vary in color from light brown to blackish and may be hairy. Small ones are very common. Larger ones, giant pigmented nevi, are rare but carry a greater potential for becoming malignant later in life. It is usually recommended that large moles and suspicious smaller ones be removed after a baby is 6 months old, if removal can be accomplished easily, and those that are not removed be monitored carefully by a dermatologist.
Baby business. It's hard to believe that a newborn baby will ever have any business to take care of besides eating, sleeping, crying, and growing. But there are two very important documents that your baby will need periodically throughout life, and both should be registered for now. One is a birth certificate, which will be needed as proof of birth and citizenship when, and all of these will come sooner than you think, registering for school and applying for a driver's license, passport, marriage license, yes, marriage license, or social security benefits. Usually, the registering of your baby's birth is handled by the hospital, and you receive official notification when the record of the birth is filed. If you don't receive such notification and a copy of the birth certificate within a couple of months, check with the hospital and the local health department or the state health department to see what's holding it up. If you gave birth at home, you or your midwife will have to register for the document. When you do receive the birth certificate, examine it carefully to be sure it's accurate. Mistakes are sometimes made. If there are errors, or if you hadn't quite settled on a name for your baby before leaving the hospital and need to add it, call the health department for instructions on how to make the necessary corrections or additions. Once you have a correct birth certificate, make a few copies and file them in a safe place. The second document that your baby will need is a Social Security card. Though it isn't likely your newborn is going to start holding down a job anytime soon, you'll need the number for other reasons, such as setting up a bank account, investing those cash gifts, obtaining medical coverage, even purchasing U.S. savings bonds. The main reason to get a Social Security number, however, is to claim your baby as a dependent on your income tax return. And if you bank baby's savings in your name and Social Security number rather than his or her own, you'll have to pay taxes on the interest at your rate rather than the baby's lower one. Application for a Social Security number can be made during the birth certificate application process in the hospital. You can simply check a box on the birth certificate information form if you want a social security number assigned to your child. The hospital forwards this information to the Social Security Administration, which then assigns the social security number and issues the card directly to you. The parent's signature on the birth registration form and the check in the box indicating the parent wants a social security card for the child constitutes a valid application for one. Or you can apply for a social security number for your baby at your local social security office in person or by mail. You can print out a form at ssa.gov/ssnumber/ss5.htm. Submitting a copy of the birth certificate, see, you need it already, plus proof of your own identity, such as a driver's license or a passport, plus the social security number of both parents. If you decide your baby doesn't need a social security number now, keep in mind that the law requires one by age 5. Social security numbers are available free of charge, so never pay anyone for getting a card or number.
Blotchy skin.
There are red blotches with white centers on my baby's face and body. Are these anything to worry about?
They may not be pretty, but they're nothing to worry about either. Just another one of the many surprisingly unsightly skin eruptions newborns can develop. So much for baby smooth skin, right? These are actually pretty common too, and though they come with a scary name, erythema toxicum, and an even scarier appearance, blotchy, irregularly shaped, reddened areas with pale centers, sort of like a collection of angry insect bites. These blemishes are happily harmless and short-lived. They will vanish within several weeks without treatment. Avoid the temptation to scrub them. Mouth cysts or spots.
When my baby was crying, I noticed a few little white bumps on her gums. Could she be getting teeth?
Don't alert the social media yet. While a baby very occasionally will sprout a couple of bottom central incisors 6 months or so before schedule, little white bumps on the gums are much more likely to be tiny, fluid-filled papules or cysts. These harmless cysts are common in newborns and will soon disappear, leaving gums clear in plenty of time for that first toothless grin. Some babies may also have yellowish white spots on the roofs of their mouths at birth. Like the cysts, they're fairly common and completely innocuous. Dubbed Epstein's pearls, these spots will disappear without treatment. Early teeth.
I was shocked to find that my baby was born with 2 front teeth. The doctor says he'll have to have them pulled. Why?
Every once in a while, a newborn arrives on the scene with a tooth or two. And though these tiny pearly whites may be cute as can be and fun to show off on Instagram, they may need to be removed if they're not well anchored in the gums to keep baby from choking on or swallowing them. Such extra early teeth may be pre-teeth or extra teeth, which once removed will be replaced by primary teeth at the usual time. But more often, they are primary teeth, and if they must be extracted, temporary dentures, which would be fitted once the rest of the primary teeth come in, may be needed to stand in for the missing teeth until their secondary successors come in. Fresh.
My baby has thick patches of white on the inside of his cheeks. I thought it was spit up milk, but when I tried to brush it away, his mouth started to bleed.
Sounds like there's a fungus among you, or more accurately, between you. Though the fungus infection known as thrush is causing problems in your baby's mouth, it probably started in your birth canal as a yeast infection, and that's where your baby picked it up. The fungus, called Candida albicans, is an organism that normally hangs out in the mouth and vagina and is typically kept in check by other microorganisms. But if you get sick, start using antibiotics, or experience hormonal changes, such as in pregnancy, the balance can be upset, allowing the fungus to grow and cause symptoms of infection. Since thrush is usually picked up at birth, it's most common in newborns and babies under 2 months. Older babies can also develop thrush if they've been taking antibiotics, have a depressed immune system, or the yeast continues to be passed back and forth between mom and baby during breastfeeding. How can you tell if your baby has thrush? Look for those trademark elevated white patches, which appear like curds of cottage cheese on the inside of a baby's cheeks and sometimes on the gums, tongue, roof of the mouth, and even the back of the throat, and touch gently with a gauze-covered finger. If it's thrush, the white patch won't come off very easily, and if it does, you'll find a raw, red patch underneath. Fussiness during feeding or when sucking on a pacifier, baby starts to suck, then turns away in pain, could be another sign of thrush, though some babies don't seem to be uncomfortable with it at all. If you suspect thrush, contact the doctor who will likely prescribe an antifungal medication, such as nystatin, which is applied topically to the inside of the mouth and tongue. Be sure to get it on all the white patches in your baby's mouth, multiple times a day for 10 days. In a tough case, Diflucan, which is an oral medication given by dropper, may be prescribed. Some babies with thrush also develop a yeast infection in the diaper region, characterized by an angry red rash. It can be treated with a different prescription antifungal medication specifically for that area. Are you breastfeeding? Then chances are your baby isn't the only one that yucky yeast is feasting on. Yeast infections are passed back from baby's mouth to mama's nipples, and then back and forth again if both members of the breastfeeding team aren't treated. Symptoms of nipple thrush include extreme soreness and burning, along with a pink, shiny, itchy, flaky, and/or crusty appearance. There may also be sharp shooting pains in the breasts during or after feeds. If you suspect you might have nipple thrush, whether or not you see thrush in your baby's mouth, contact the doctor. Breastfeeding doesn't have to be interrupted if one or both of you have been diagnosed with thrush, but the condition can make feeding excruciating for you. Another reason why prompt treatment for both of you is needed. You'll likely be prescribed an antifungal cream that you'll apply to your nipples. If it's practical, for example, if you have the privacy and cooperative weather, you can also try exposing your nipples to sunlight for a few minutes each day, since yeast hates the sun. Probiotics may help speed recovery and keep yeast at bay, and they're safe to take while you're breastfeeding. There are also infant probiotics that the doctor may prescribe for your baby. To avoid future infections, as well as to prevent reinfection, regularly clean and sterilize pacifiers, bottles, and breast pump parts that touch your nipples. Using a microwave sterilizer bag makes this easier. Also helpful, allowing your nipples to completely dry between feedings, changing nursing pads after feedings, and wearing cotton bras that don't trap moisture, and washing them daily in hot water. Drying them in the sun may provide extra protection. Since antibiotics can trigger a yeast infection, they should be used only when needed, and that goes for both you and baby.
A milky tongue. Ever wonder why your baby's tongue is white after a feed, or even worried that it might be due to thrush? If a white tongue is your baby's only symptom, his or her milk-only diet is probably the cause. Milk residue often stays on a baby's tongue after feeding, but usually dissolves within an hour. Still want to be sure? Simply try to wipe off that white film using a soft, damp cloth. If the tongue is pink and healthy looking after wiping, it's just a matter of milk. Call the doctor if you suspect thrush or if you're just not sure.
Jaundice.
The doctor says my baby is jaundiced and has to spend time under the billy lights before she can go home. He says it isn't serious, but anything that keeps a baby in the hospital sounds serious to me.
The skin of more than half of babies has begun to yellow by their second or third days, not with age, but with newborn jaundice caused by an excess of bilirubin in the blood. The yellowing, which starts at the head and works its way down toward the toes, tints the skin in light-skinned newborns and even the whites of their eyes. The process is the same in black and brown-skinned babies, but the yellowing may be visible only in the palms of the hands, the soles of the feet, and the whites of the eyes. Jaundice is more common in babies of East Asian or Mediterranean descent, though their dark, olive, or yellow-tinged skin may make it more difficult to detect. Bilirubin, a chemical formed during the normal breakdown of red blood cells, is usually removed from the blood by the liver. But newborns often produce more bilirubin than their immature livers can handle. As a result, the bilirubin builds up in the blood, causing the yellowish tinge and what is known as physiologic or normal newborn jaundice. In physiologic jaundice, yellowing usually begins on the second or third day of life, peaks by the fifth day, and is substantially diminished by the time baby is a week or 10 days old. It appears a bit later, about the third or fourth day, and lasts longer, often 14 days or more, in premature babies because of their extremely immature livers. Jaundice is more likely to occur in babies who lose a lot of weight right after delivery, in babies who have diabetic mothers, and in babies who arrived via induced labor. Mild to moderate physiologic jaundice usually requires no treatment. Usually a doctor will keep a baby with high physiologic jaundice in the hospital for a few extra days for observation and phototherapy treatment under fluorescent light, often called a billy light. Light alters bilirubin, making it easier for baby's liver to get rid of it. During the treatment, babies are naked except for diapers, and their eyes are covered to protect them from the light. They are also given extra fluid to compensate for the increased water loss through the skin. Freestanding units, fiber optic blankets, or specialized jaundice treatment pads, some LED-based, allow more flexibility, often not requiring baby to stay in the hospital. In almost all cases, the bilirubin levels, determined through blood tests, will gradually diminish in an infant who's been treated, and the baby will go home with a clean bill of health. Rarely the bilirubin increases further or more rapidly than expected, suggesting that the jaundice may be non-physiologic, not normal. This type of jaundice usually begins either earlier or later than physiologic jaundice, and levels of bilirubin are higher. Treatment to bring down abnormally high levels of bilirubin is important to prevent a buildup of the substance in the brain, a condition known as kernicterus. Signs of kernicterus are weak crying, sluggish reflexes, and poor sucking in a very jaundiced infant. A baby who's being treated under lights may also seem sluggish, but that's from being warm and understimulated, not from kernicterus. Untreated, kernicterus can lead to permanent brain damage or even death. Many hospitals monitor the level of bilirubin in baby's blood through blood tests or with a special measurement device, a bilirubinometer, and follow-up visits to ensure that these extremely rare cases of kernicterus are not missed. The pediatrician will also check baby's color at the first visit to screen for non-physiologic jaundice, especially important if mom and baby checked out of the hospital early or if baby was born at home. The treatment of non-physiologic jaundice will depend on the cause, but may include phototherapy, blood transfusions, or surgery. Any visible jaundice that persists at 3 weeks of age should be checked by the pediatrician.
I've heard that breastfeeding causes jaundice. My baby is a little jaundiced. Should I stop nursing?
Blood bilirubin levels are, on the average, higher in breastfed babies than in bottle-fed infants, and they may stay elevated longer, as long as 6 weeks. Not only is this exaggerated physiologic or normal jaundice nothing to worry about, but it's also not a reason to consider giving up on breastfeeding. In fact, interrupting breastfeeding doesn't decrease bilirubin levels and can interfere with the establishment of lactation. What's more, it's been suggested that breastfeeding in the first hour after birth can reduce bilirubin levels in nursing infants. True breast milk jaundice is suspected when levels of bilirubin rise rapidly late in the first week of life, and non-physiologic jaundice has been ruled out. It's believed to be caused by a substance in the breast milk of some women that interferes with the breakdown of bilirubin and is estimated to occur in about 2% of breastfed babies. In most cases, it clears up on its own within a few weeks without any treatment and without interrupting breastfeeding. If it doesn't clear up by 3 weeks, check back with the pediatrician. Stool color.
When I changed my baby's diaper for the first time, his poop was greenish black. Is this normal?
This is only the first of many discoveries you'll make in your baby's diapers during the next year or so. And for the most part, what you will be discovering, though occasionally unsettling, will be completely normal. What you've turned up this time is meconium, the tarry, greenish-black substance that gradually filled your baby's intestines during his stay in your uterus. That the meconium is in his diaper instead of his intestines is a good sign. Now you know that his bowels are doing their job. Sometime after the first 24 hours, when all the meconium has been passed, you'll see transitional stools, which are dark greenish-yellow and loose, sometimes seedy in texture, particularly among breastfed infants, and may occasionally contain mucus. There may even be traces of blood in them, probably the result of a baby swallowing some of his mom's blood during delivery. Just to be sure, save any diaper containing blood to show to a doctor or nurse. After 3 or 4 days of transitional stools, what your baby starts putting out will depend on what you've been putting into him. If it's breast milk, the movements will often be mustard-like in color and consistency, sometimes loose, even watery, sometimes seedy, mushy, or curdy. If it's formula, the stool will usually be soft but better formed than a breastfed baby's, and anywhere from pale yellow to yellowish brown, light brown, or brown green. Iron in baby's diet, whether from formula or vitamin drops, can also lend a black or dark green hue to movements. Whatever you do, don't compare your baby's diapers with those of the baby in the next bassinet. Like fingerprints, no two stools are exactly alike. And unlike fingerprints, they are different not only from baby to baby, but also from day to day, even poop to poop, in any one baby. The changes, as you will see when baby moves on to solids, would become more pronounced as his diet becomes more varied.
The scoop on newborn poop. So you think if you've seen one dirty diaper, you've seen them all? Far from it. Though what goes into your baby at this point is definitely one of two things, breast milk or formula, what comes out can be one of many. In fact, the color and texture of baby poop can change from day to day and bowel movement to bowel movement, causing even seasoned parents to scratch their head. Here's the scoop on what the contents of your baby's diaper may mean. Sticky, tar-like, black, or dark green. Meconium, a newborn's first few stools. Grainy, greenish-yellow, or brown. Transitional stools, which start turning up on the third or fourth day after birth. Seedy, curdy, creamy or lumpy, light yellow to mustard or bright green, normal breast milk stools. Slightly formed, light brownish to bright yellow to dark green, normal formula stools. Frequent, watery, greener than usual, diarrhea. Hard, pellet-like, mucus or blood-streaked, constipation. Black, iron supplementation, red-streaked, milk allergy or rectal fissure, a tear around the rectum, usually due to constipation. Mucusy, green or light yellow, a virus, such as a cold or stomach bug.
Pacifier use. Will my baby become addicted to the pacifier if she gets one in the hospital? Babies are born suckers, which makes pacifiers pretty popular in the hospital, both with newborn patients and those who care for them. Not only won't she get hooked from a day or two of pacifier use, but as long as your little sucker is also getting her full share of feeds, enjoying a little between-meal soothing from a soothie is no problem at all. In fact, there are benefits to pacifier use. The AAP suggests that parents consider offering one during sleep to protect against SIDS, a good reason to get baby started on one early. Wait too long to introduce a pacifier, and your little one may resist. Nursing mamas can pop the Passy too without concern about it causing nipple confusion or interfering with breastfeeding. There's no consensus that either is true. However, if you're concerned about the pacifier satisfying too much of your baby's sucking needs, especially if you're breastfeeding, and particularly if she hasn't been feeding all that well yet, you may decide you'd rather the staff not offer a pacifier when she's in the hospital. Don't be shy about letting them know that you'd prefer to feed her when she cries, or if she's just finished up a feed, using other comfort measures instead of plugging in the Passy.
Going home. In the 1930s, healthy new babies and their moms came home from the hospital after a whopping 10 days. In the 1950s, after 4 days. In the 1980s, after 2 days. Then, in the 1990s, insurance companies, in a cost-cutting effort, began limiting hospital stays to just hours. To protect against such so-called drive-through deliveries, the federal government passed the Newborns and Mothers Health Protection Act in 1996. The law requires insurance companies to pay for a 48-hour hospital stay following a vaginal birth and 96 hours following a cesarean delivery, though some practitioners and mothers may opt for a shorter stay if baby is healthy and mom is up to going home sooner. Itching for your own bed and hungry for some real food? The decision to check out early is best made on a case-by-case basis with a physician's input. Early discharge is safest when an infant is full term, is an appropriate weight, has started feeding well, is going home with a parent or parents who knows the basics and is well enough to provide care, and will be seen by a practitioner, doctor, nurse practitioner, or visiting nurse within 2 days of discharge. If you and your baby are discharged early, or if you delivered at home, make sure you schedule that first checkup within the next 48 hours. In the meantime, watch carefully for signs of newborn problems that require immediate medical attention, such as a refusal to eat, dehydration, fewer than 6 wet diapers in 24 hours, or dark yellow urine, constant crying, moaning instead of crying, or no crying at all, fever, or red or purple dots anywhere on the skin. Also keep an eye out for signs of jaundice, which include yellowing of the eyes and of the skin in light-skinned babies, and yellowing of the eyes, palms of the hands, and soles of the feet in dark-skinned newborns. To run a check for jaundice in your newborn, press down on his or her thigh or arm with your thumb. If the skin turns yellowish instead of white, your little one may be jaundiced. On dark-skinned or Asian babies, the Blanch test is done on the inner cheek or lip, or on the palms and soles of the feet. A safe ride home. Starting with that first ride home from the hospital, and every ride after that, Your baby will have to be properly secured into a properly installed car seat. That's because safety seats, like seat belts, are the law. Not to mention that an unstrapped baby is an unsafe baby. Car crashes are a leading cause of injury and death among children. So even if your destination is literally just a few blocks away, most accidents occur within 25 miles of home and not, as is often believed, on highways. Even if you're driving slowly, a crash at 30 miles per hour creates as much force as a fall from a third-story window. Even if you're wearing a seatbelt and holding your baby tight, in a crash, baby could be crushed by your body or whipped from your arms. Even if you're driving very carefully, you don't actually have to crash for severe injuries to result. Many occur when a car stops short or swerves to avoid an accident. And even if you're just going from one space to another in the same parking lot, your baby needs to be buckled up safely. Getting your baby used to a safety seat from the very first ride will help make later acceptance of it almost automatic. And young children who ride in safety restraints regularly are not only safer, but also better behaved during drives, something you'll appreciate when you're riding with a toddler. In addition to checking that seat meets federal safety standards, be sure that it is appropriate for your baby's age and weight and that you install and use it correctly. Follow manufacturer's directions for installation of the seat and securing of your baby. Check before each ride that the seat is properly secured and the seat belts or latch system holding it are snugly fastened. The car seat should not wobble, pivot, slide side to side, tip over, or move more than an inch when you push it from front to back or side to side. Instead, when properly installed, it should stay tight. You'll know the rear-facing infant seat is installed tightly enough if, when you hold the top edge of the car seat and try to push it downward, the back of the seat stays firmly in place at the same angle. To make sure you've installed the car seat correctly, have it assessed. Car seat safety checks are offered at fire and police stations, hospitals, car dealerships, baby stores, and other locations. Keep in mind, however, that only a certified car seat safety technician is likely to be up to date on all the latest recommendations. For peace of mind at a price, a relatively small one, you can search locally for a certified car seat technician to install your car seat or check your work at cert.safekids.org. Infants should ride in a rear-facing car seat, reclining at a 45-degree angle, until they reach the highest weight or height allowed by the seat, usually for 2 years or more. Experts say that a rear-facing child safety seat does a much better job of protecting a young child in a car crash. Babies and young toddlers are 75% less likely to be severely or fatally injured in a crash if they are riding rear-facing. That's because in a rear-facing car seat, the child's head, neck, and spine are better supported, making the risk of serious injury much less likely. The majority of kids don't hit the upper weight limit for the car seat until somewhere after age 2, but some toddlers may be big enough to be turned forward-facing earlier than age 2. Once baby has outgrown the infant seat, use a convertible seat, which can accommodate larger babies in the rear-facing position. Place the infant safety seat, if at all possible, in the middle of the back seat, if there's a latch system in the middle seat. If not, then use one of the window seats with a latch system. Never put an ordinary rear-facing infant seat in the front seat of a car equipped with a passenger side airbag. If the airbag is inflated, which could happen even at slow speeds in a fender bender, the force could seriously injure or kill a baby. In fact, the safest place for all children under 13 is in the back seat. Older children should ride up front only when absolutely necessary and when safely restrained and sitting as far from the passenger side airbag as possible. Adjust the shoulder harness to fit your baby. The harness slots on a rear-facing safety seat should be at or below your baby's shoulders, and the harness chest clip should be at armpit level. The straps should lie flat and untwisted and should be tight enough so that you can't get more than 2 fingers between the harness and your baby's collarbone. Check the instructions to see how the carrying handle should be positioned during travel, if applicable. Dress your baby in clothes that allow straps to go between his or her legs. In cold weather, place blankets on top of your strapped-in baby, after adjusting the harness straps snugly, rather than dressing baby in a snowsuit. A heavy snowsuit can come between your baby and an adequately tight harness. Most infant seats come with special cushioned inserts to keep a very young baby's head from flopping around. If not, pad the sides of the car seat and the area around the head and neck with a rolled blanket, but never underneath baby, and never use inserts that don't come with the car seat. It not only will void the warranty, but it could also make baby unsafe. For older babies, attach soft toys to the seat with Velcro or plastic links, never a cord that's 6 inches or longer. Loose toys tend to be flung around the car or dropped, upsetting baby and distracting the driver. Or use toys designed specifically for car seat use. Many infant car seats can lock into shopping carts, something that's sure to be convenient, but is also potentially dangerous. The weight of the baby and car seat makes the shopping cart top-heavy and more likely to tip over. So be extra vigilant when placing your baby's car seat on a shopping cart. Or, as recommended by the AAP, for optimum safety, use a sling, baby carrier, or stroller when shopping. The Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, recommends using a child's safety seat in flight, secured with the airplane seatbelt, until age 4. Most infant, convertible, and forward-facing seats are certified for use on airplanes. See Chapter 2 for more on choosing an infant safety seat, the types of harnesses available, and other safety information. For specific information about installing your car seat, to find out if your car seat has been recalled, and for other safety information, consult the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration at nhtsa.gov/safety/CPS. The most important rule of car seat safety is never make an exception. Whenever the car is moving, everyone in the car should be safely and appropriately buckled up. All about baby care basics.
Put the diaper on backward. Took 5 minutes to get baby positioned for a productive burp. Forgot to wash under the arms at bath time. No sweat. Not only are babies forgiving when it comes to minor baby care mishaps, but they usually don't even notice. Still, like every new parent, you'll want to do the best job you possibly can taking care of your newborn, even if that personal best is far from parenting perfection. These baby care basics will help guide you to that goal. But remember, what follows are only suggested ways to care for your baby. You'll probably stumble, sometimes literally, on strategies that work better for both of you. As long as it's a safe way to go, go for it. Diapering baby. Especially in the early months, the time for a diaper change can come all too often. Sometimes hourly during baby's waking hours. Sometimes, especially for the breastfed newborn, even more frequently. But while it might not be the best part of your new job, that would be those warm snuggles, it's a necessary one. And in fact, frequent changes taking place at the very least before or after every daytime feeding if baby's wet and whenever your baby poops are the best way to keep that sweet but sensitive bottom free of irritation and diaper rash. You won't have to play diaper detective to figure out when it's time for a change. You'll know when your baby poops, the grunts will clue you in, and if you miss those, you'll get a whiff quick enough. As far as how you can tell if your little one has peed, it's pretty elementary. Cloth diapers will feel wet. Disposables with a liquid-sensitive color-changing stripe will give you the sign. And if you have the standard type of disposable, a quick look and sniff will tell you what you need to know. Waking a sleeping baby to change a diaper is hardly ever necessary. And unless baby's very wet and uncomfortable, or has had a poop, you don't need to change diapers at nighttime feedings, when activity and light can interfere
with babies getting back to sleep. To ensure a change for the better whenever you change your baby's diaper. Number one, before you begin to change a diaper, be sure everything you need is at hand, either on the changing table or, if you're away from home, in your diaper bag. Otherwise, you could end up removing a messy diaper only to find out you have nothing to clean the mess with. You will need all or some of the following. A clean diaper. Cotton balls and warm water, or a chemical-free wipe, like water wipes, for babies under 1 month, or those with diaper rash, and a small towel or dry washcloth for drying. Diaper wipes for other babies. A change of clothes if the diaper has leaked. It happens with the best of them. Clean diaper wraps or waterproof pants if you're using cloth diapers. Ointment or cream if needed for diaper rash. No need for lotions, baby oil, or powder. Number two, wash and dry your hands before you begin, if possible, or give them a once-over with a diaper wipe. Number three, have baby entertainment on hand. Live shows are a baby's favorite. Cooing, funny faces, songs, backed up by other diversions, which can be a mobile hanging over the changing table, a stuffed toy or two in baby's range of vision, and later within reach, a music box, a mechanical toy, whatever will hold your baby's interest long enough for you to take off one diaper and put on another. Number four, spread a protective cloth diaper or a changing cloth if you're changing baby anywhere but on a changing table. Wherever you make the change, be careful not to leave baby unattended, not even for a moment, not even before rolling over has been accomplished. Even strapped to a changing table, your baby shouldn't be out of arm's reach. Number five, unfasten the diaper, but don't remove it yet. First, survey the scene. If there's a bowel movement, use the diaper to wipe most of it away. Now fold the diaper under the baby with the unsoiled side up to act as a protective surface and clean baby's front thoroughly with warm water or a wipe, being sure to get into all the creases. Then lift both legs, clean the buttocks, and slip the soiled diaper out and a fresh diaper under before releasing the legs. Pat baby dry if you used water. Make sure baby's bottom is completely dry before putting on the clean diaper or any ointments or creams. If the umbilical stump is still attached, fold the diaper down to expose the raw area to air and keep it from getting wet, or use newborn diapers that have a special notched top. And be sure to fasten the diaper snugly to minimize leaks, but not so tightly that irritation occurs. Telltale marks will warn you that the diaper is too tight. Got a boy baby? Keep a fresh diaper over that penis for as much of this process as possible in self-defense. Also, expect to see erections. They happen often during diaper changes, and that's completely normal. Don't be afraid of cleaning under and around the scrotum and penis. Just be gentle, of course. Before closing the diaper, try aiming your baby boy's penis down, which will help prevent wetness from creeping up and drenching his clothes. Number six, dispose of diapers in a sanitary way. Used disposable diapers can be folded over, tightly reclosed, and dropped into a diaper pail or the garbage can. Used cloth diapers should be kept in a tightly covered diaper pail until wash day or pickup, though you'll probably want to scrape off and flush away anything solid first. A good reason to consider a flushable liner. If you're away from home, they can be held in a plastic bag until you get back. Number seven, change baby's clothing and or sheet as needed. Number eight, wash your hands with soap and water when possible, or clean them thoroughly with a diaper wipe, antibacterial wipes, or hand sanitizer. Burping baby. Milk isn't all baby swallows during a feed. Along with that nutritive fluid comes non-nutritive air, which can make a baby feel uncomfortably full before the meal is finished. To help bring up any excess air baby swallows, the doctor may recommend you burp baby between breaths or mid-bottle, or every ounce, depending on your baby. Research shows that burping isn't always necessary, doesn't lower colic rates, and may increase spitting up in some babies who actually do better when they self-burp as needed. Still, burping may help a super gassy baby who's seeking relief, and parents seeking a solution. There are three basic ways to burp a baby: on your shoulder, face down on your lap, or sitting up. And it's a good idea to try them all to see which gets the job done best for your little one. Though a gentle pat or rub may get the burp up for most babies, some need a slightly firmer hand. On your shoulder, hold baby firmly against your shoulder, supporting the buttocks with one hand and patting or rubbing the back, focusing on the left side of baby's body, which is where the stomach is, with the other. Face down on your lap. Turn baby face down on your lap, with that tummy over one leg, head resting on the other. Holding him or her securely with one hand, pat or rub with the other. Sitting up. Sit baby on your lap, head leaning forward, chest supported by your arm as you hold him or her under the chin. Pat or rub, being sure not to let baby's head flop backward. Bathing baby. Until a baby starts getting down and dirty on all fours, a daily bath definitely isn't needed. As long as adequate spot cleaning is done during diaper changes and after feedings, a bath two or three times a week in the pre-mobile months will keep baby smelling sweet and looking fresh. Welcome news if he or she doesn't exactly appreciate those dunks in the tub. Sponging can stand in between baths as needed. Your little ducky loves the tub? There's no harm in daily dunks unless dry skin is an issue. Though just about any time of the day can be the right time for a newborn bath, a before-bedtime slot makes the most sense. After all, warm water relaxes, soothes, and induces sleepiness. Plus, as babies start spending the days getting dirty, nighttime baths will be smart on all fronts and backsides, while becoming a treasured part of the bedtime ritual. Avoid baths just after or just before a meal, since spitting up could be the result of so much handling on a full tummy, and baby may not be cooperative on an empty one. Allot plenty of undivided time for the bath, so it won't be hurried and you won't be tempted to leave baby unattended even for a second to take care of something else. The changing table, a kitchen counter, your bed, or the baby's crib if the mattress is high enough, or really any surface that can be easily covered with a waterproof pad or thick towel, are all suitable locations for a sponge bath. Once baby has graduated from sponging to soaking, you can opt for the kitchen or bathroom sink, or a portable tub placed on a counter or in the big tub. Though the maneuvering involved when bathing a tiny baby while bending and stretching over a tub can be tricky. Your work surface should be comfortable for you to access and roomy enough to hold all your bath supplies. A toasty, draft-free room temperature will be most comfy for baby, especially during those early months. Aim for about 75 degrees Fahrenheit to 80 degrees Fahrenheit. A bathroom can be quickly warmed up with shower steam, and turn off any fans and air conditioners until the bath is over. Have the following ready before undressing baby. Warm water if you won't be within reach of a faucet. Baby wash and shampoo if you use it. Two washcloths,
One will do if you use your hand for sudsing. Cotton balls for cleaning the eyes. Towel, preferably with a hood. Clean diaper, diaper ointment, or cream if you use it, and clothing. The sponge bath. Until the umbilical cord and circumcision site, if any, are healed. A couple of weeks, more or less, tub baths will be taboo, and a washcloth will be your baby's only route to clean. For a thorough sponge bath, follow these steps. Number 1. Get baby ready. If the room is warm, you can remove all of baby's clothing before beginning, covering him or her loosely with a towel while you work. Most babies dislike being totally bare. If the room is on the cooler side, undress each part of the body as you're ready to wash it. No matter what the room temperature, don't take off baby's diaper until it's time to wash the bottom. An undiapered baby, especially a boy, should always be considered armed and dangerous. Number 2. Begin washing, starting with the cleanest areas of the body and working toward the dirtiest, so that the washcloth and the water you're using will stay clean. Suds up as needed with your hands or washcloth, but use a clean cloth for rinsing. This order of business usually works well. Head. Once or twice a week, use baby wash or baby shampoo, rinsing very thoroughly. The rest of the time, you can just use water. A careful hold at the sink's edge can be the easiest and most comfortable way to rinse your baby's head. Gently towel dry baby's hair. For most babies, this takes just a few seconds before proceeding. Face. First, using a cotton ball moistened in warm water, clean baby's eyes, wiping gently from the inner corner of the eye outward. Use a fresh ball for each eye. No baby wash is needed for the face. Wipe around the outer ears, but not inside. Gently pat dry all parts of the face. Neck, chest, and abdomen. Sudsing up is not necessary here unless baby is very sweaty or dirty. Be sure to get into those abundant folds and creases where dirt tends to accumulate. Maneuver carefully around the umbilical cord. It's okay to gently wipe away any crust that accumulates around the stump. Pat dry. Arms. Extend those little arms to get into the elbow creases and press the palms to open the fists. The hands will need a bit of baby wash, but be sure to rinse them well before they're back in baby's mouth. Dry. Back. Turn baby over on the tummy with head to one side and wash the back, being sure not to miss those neck folds. Since this isn't a dirty area, sudsing probably won't be necessary. Dry and dress the upper body before continuing if the room is chilly. Legs. Extend the legs to get the backs of the knees, though baby will probably resist being unfurled. Dry. Diaper area. Follow directions for care of the circumcised or uncircumcised penis. Wash girls front to back, spreading the labia and cleaning with baby wash and water. A white vaginal discharge is normal, so don't try to scrub it away. Use a fresh section of the cloth and clean water or fresh water poured from a cup to rinse the vagina. Wash boys carefully, getting into all the creases and crevices with baby wash and water, but don't try to retract the foreskin on an uncircumcised baby. Dry the diaper area well and apply ointment or cream if needed. Number 3. Diaper and dress baby. The baby tub bath. A baby is ready for a tub bath as soon as both umbilical cord stump and circumcision, if any, are healed. If baby doesn't seem to like being in the water, go back to sponge baths for a few days before trying again. Here are the steps to take when tub bathing a baby. Number 1.
Before you add the baby, run enough water into the baby tub so that when you place baby into the bath, he or she will be covered with water up to the chest. Test the water temperature with your elbow to be sure it's comfortably warm. Never run the water with baby in the tub because a sudden temperature change might occur. Don't add baby wash or bubble bath to the water, as these can be drying to baby's skin and also up the chances of a UTI, urinary tract infection, and other irritations. Number 2. Undress baby completely. Number 3. Slip baby gradually into the bath, talking in soothing and reassuring tones and holding on securely to prevent a startle reflex. Support the neck and head with one hand unless the tub has built-in support or if your baby seems to prefer your arms to the tub support until good head control develops. Hold baby securely in a semi-reclining position. Slipping under suddenly could result in a scare. Number 4. With your free hand, wash baby, working from the cleanest to the dirtiest areas. First, using a cotton ball moistened in warm water, clean baby's eyes,